This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. One documentary film a month with the Marketplace team for Econ Extra Credit. This month, we turn to a poetic look at a policy issue, criminal justice culture. The film is called The Prison in 12 Landscapes. And if you missed my conversation with its director, Brett Story, on the air, it's streamable at marketplace.org. One of the movie's landscapes is the true story of the California inmate whose prison job is with a crew that fights wildfires. Despite this work experience, she worries about finding employment upon release. Well, let's talk to someone who's researched this. Hadar Aviram is a professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Good morning.
Good morning.
In this film, we see a California wildfire at first. It turns out that one of those working on the fire line to keep it from spreading is an inmate in prison in a special prison work program. Would a program like that be common or fairly rare?
Here in California, it's extremely common. And among the people who saved probably thousands of lives in the last summer when we had the wildfires were many, many incarcerated people working as firefighters.
It's interesting, right? Because often people don't know that. In fact, there's a ban on inmates speaking with members of the public while out there fighting the fire.
Yes, there are many limitations on people working in these occupations. And because of that, the public is unaware of the fact that many of the people that they interact with every day are working as incarcerated people. A lot of the customer service on the phone, a lot of the furniture, things that are being manufactured, sweatshirts for dozens of Ivy League universities are made in a prison in Kansas, where people are getting paid 50 cents a day. It's really astounding the range of occupations that people have in prison. And I think that firefighting is an especially interesting example because they are saving lives and they are working shoulder to shoulder with professional non-incarcerated firefighters. The big irony, of course, is that then they get out, and at least until recently, they couldn't get a job as firefighters despite being trained because they have a criminal record.
I mean, that's the thing. There's, of course, a move that we've spent some time covering on this program to ban employers for in the first initial part of a job application asking if you have a criminal record. But employers have a way of finding out anyway, or it comes up during the background check.
Absolutely. I was one of the big pushers for this kind of, we call it ban the box initiatives, to screen people without knowing their criminal record. But it turns out, colleagues of mine at the Urban Institute did a study, and they found out that rather than employers discriminating on the basis of criminal records, they have started discriminating on the basis of race as a proxy for criminal records. So for example, they'll get job applications and they don't know which of the people have a criminal record, but they will interview the person called Brad rather than the person called Jamal, under the assumption that they are using this as a proxy for the criminal record that they don't have an access to. It's very frustrating because you're trying to create equal opportunities for everybody, but these things have such a protean quality that they pop up no matter what kind of protections you introduce in the workplace.
What do you do about that? I mean, you know, there's an ongoing national discussion at some level about what we're addressing here, but in part, when people have worked alongside people that they find out have criminal records and they see firsthand that they're like the rest of us, sometimes that can help break down these stereotypes.
Absolutely. And this is a truth that has been found in studies all over. I mean, people have done studies, for example, of members of fundamentalist churches that will be railing against single mothers and gay people, but then they have a gay uncle or a niece who's a single mom and they love them to bits. And that softens a little bit this approach. And the same thing holds for people with criminal records. I just saw a study done at a college where there was a strong correlation between students who personally knew fellow students who were formerly incarcerated and their opinions about would they befriend somebody with a criminal record? Would they be willing to date somebody who had been in prison? So truly personal acquaintances and education and exposure is the most important thing that we can do to break down these barriers.
Back to this notion of inmate labor. When the phone rings at our house, it could be an inmate at the other end of the line.
Yes, absolutely. This is just one of many, many, many occupations that people engage in prisons. Phone solicitation, customer service, a lot of manufacturing of everyday items that you wouldn't even have an idea come from prison. And of course, a lot of the work inside prisons. I don't know that a lot of people know this. We have a high population of people who are aging and infirm in prison. And oftentimes the people taking care of them are trained caregivers who are incarcerated themselves. So a lot of the things that we think the state is providing, it's actually people from inside the prison who are incarcerated themselves who are doing it.
What's your sense, having studied this? I mean, is it by definition prison labor exploitative? I mean, no one's paid market rates for that labor.
This is a complicated question because there's the world that we would want to live in which everybody gets minimum wage and in which you are actually trained for the reality of the marketplace. And there's the realities of the world we're in which prison labor to different extents is exploitative. And we therefore try to sort of improve people's lot within the conditions that they're in. We have to keep in mind the fact that to some extent, prison labor is training people for conditions in the market on the outside. But the problem is that oftentimes prisons turn to these work programs because they think they're going to be rehabilitative or whatever. But for the most part, it's economic considerations of the prison itself. The programs themselves are very selective. It's difficult to get into them. Not all of them are evidence-based. So oftentimes they will train people to do jobs that they can't actually get on the outside. Up until recently, the firefighting was one such example, but there are many other examples. The programs that do have occupations where people can work on the outside, like marine technology or carpentry, are highly selective. Very, very few people can get in. So overall, a more realistic prospect for people coming out is to become independent contractors and work for themselves.
That's what people end up doing, working for themselves?
Exactly. So for example, you'll find people that are putting together landscaping companies, housework companies. And there are some examples that are really amazing of nonprofits that people have put on the outside where they're working in the marketplace and just doing amazing things. Right next to Hastings, which is where I teach, is a neighborhood called the Tenderloin in San Francisco, which during the pandemic became pretty much an open-air drug market. Lots of homeless people, lots of misery, mental health, substance abuse, oftentimes people overdosing. And the mayor was upset by this, and a couple of times they sent the police to clean up the neighborhood with everything that stems from that. And that was extremely difficult because there were no solutions for people. Rather than just sort of cleaning up the aesthetics. And then a nonprofit stepped in called Urban Alchemy. They operate public restrooms, which is incredibly important in these kinds of neighborhoods. They operated safe sleeping sites during COVID. They calmed down violence. They actually revived people with naloxone who had overdosed multiple times every week. They did amazing things. And what enables them to do this work more effectively and more peacefully than the police and almost without any show of force is the fact that they are former lifers, that the people who work at Urban Alchemy acquired these peacemaking and mentoring skills that they use every day on the job in decades in prison. They were elders and mentors on the yard when they were inside, and they retain this kind of calm mentorship role on the outside. And they have done such an amazing job that the change in energy in the neighborhood is palpable.
So those are special skills that are in demand. It's a shame that some employers don't fully recognize this.
Exactly. There are many ways in which we look at a criminal record or a previous prison stay as a liability. This is, of course, difficult because at any given moment, 1% of the entire population of the United States is incarcerated. So we have a lot of people who actually have acquired skills and strengths where they were that we can use in the marketplace. I'm not just thinking about occupations that are entry-level jobs. I'm thinking even about entry into, say, the California bar as lawyers. Think about what somebody brings in, coming in with an insider perspective on a criminal justice system, reassuring their clients about what's going to happen to them, you know, being able to present a realistic perspective. There are so many strengths that you acquire. One of the most successful programs we have in California is called Marine Technologies, is people who work underwater fixing ships and underwater structures. And this is partly a skill where it's a great advantage to be used to being in a very overcrowded environment. This is difficult for a lot of people, but people, unfortunately, who spend time in our grossly overcrowded prisons have acquired this skill. This is a market strength that is being undervalued and stigmatized for no good reason.
I was reading about that Marine program. Recidivism, going back to the ways of crime, is near zero for people who've gone through that program.
Those are good jobs. If you get a job like that, there is no reason for you to commit crime, because you have gainful employment. We have to think more evidence-based about these kinds of programs and strengths in the market and prepare people for that.
Those programs often can be expensive within the prison. Sometimes when budgets are tight, as you've written, that's the program that gets cut.
Exactly. It's one of the downsides, and this is something that I wrote in my first book, Cheap on Crime, that we overall saw the prison population shrink since 2009. This was a result of the recession of 2008. But one of the side effects of that were more sinister is also that there were drastic cuts to rehabilitative programming. And that created a big difference, a big gap between prisons that are set in urban centers where there's lots of volunteers and do-gooders that step in and create these programs. Here, for example, in St. Quentin, we have Silicon Valley entrepreneurs volunteering to teach people the internet, which is very difficult when you don't have internet behind bars. So we have all of this programming because of the volunteers, because they're stepping in to fill in the gaps that the state cannot fill. But there are many, many prisons in the United States that are located in these remote, rural locations, very, very difficult to get there, and very difficult to get quality programming that actually prepares people to get good jobs once they get released.
Hadar Aviram is a professor at the University of California Hastings School of Law. Her book from 2015 is called Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.